and mastered alcoholism and drug addiction to an unprecedented level from what I had known before. And I spent very little time thinking about what I might say tonight. It's been a while since I actually spoke and told my story. But I think I want to focus a little more on the first 18 years than I ever have in my past, as I've heard some people speak in the last 5 years and, you know, what really got them to that point. My parents were, I was in my late 30s, 36 maybe, when my parents got divorced. And they were one of those couples that should have never got together, really. And they always said things like, "We stayed together for you kids." And so as I look back on that, I know that that put a lot of guilt on me and my brothers as kids. Life was always really chaotic in my house. My dad, I didn't realize it until I was about 46. You know, I'd been sober for a couple of years, and I realized that my father, who was a police officer at the time that I was a child, suffered from addiction. And they just never said that in the late 60s and early 70s. You just didn't tell people that, you know, you were an addict if you were a cop. He was a Vietnam veteran. He suffered from PTSD severely, and migraines that came with that. And he got addicted to, you know, Vicodin and things like that. And I just didn't know it. I had no clue. He spent long spans of time, you know, 8 to 10 days at a time, locked in the bedroom sleeping. And that made my mom really angry, raising two little boys by herself. And she took that out on us. And I was really mad at her for a long time about that. And I still struggle with it to this day at age 50, and she only lives about 15 minutes from here. It's probably been a year since I spoke with her in person or on the phone. And so I grew up in this household where Dad was there, but he was emotionally unavailable, and Mom was just angry all the time. She was very physically abusive, very mentally abusive, very emotionally abusive, and Dad wasn't there. And so that's how I grew up. And as I was doing some thinking this afternoon on the way out here, I realized something my daughter said to me today. She said, "Dad," because we talk about recovery in my house like you do breakfast at your house. It's just how we live our lives today. So this fear of financial insecurity that I've had my whole life, money was something I could control from a very young age. I started working really early. I was always very motivated. You know, I lived in a state that had four seasons, so I could push a lawnmower in the summer, and I could push a snow shovel in the winter. And I did that aggressively. And I made a lot of money as a kid. I got my first full-time job when I was 11. And I say full-time, it was about 32 hours a week, and it was after school at night from about 4 p.m. to 10 p.m., driving a tractor and taking care of some softball fields in the park in my hometown. They had a really nice facility there that people from all over the Northwest would come and use for tournaments. And, you know, I thought that was pretty cool shit. They trusted me with the key to this compound and this tractor, and they were paying me $400 a month to do it as an 11-year-old. And so that, I never really realized it until just recently, but that drive to control the way I felt with money, right? I also suffered from this lack of attention from my parents that led me to be an attention seeker. I would do anything to get people to like me or pay attention to me. And I realized having money, it fit that bill. Like, there was a lot of 11-year-old kids that had never seen $400. So for me to always have a pocket full of money, people always wanted to be around me, and I liked that. You know, I had other friends that had a paper route, and I had to outdo them. I had four. In addition to the pushing the snow shovel and the lawnmower and washing cars and just doing anything else anybody needed me to do. So I've been looking at that a lot lately, and it goes all the way back to being a young boy, this fixing my feelings with money. Food was another one. I'm not a poster child for anorexia or bulimia, but I suffered from an eating disorder my whole life. I would eat till I was miserably full after I was blasted, intoxicated. And I woke up every day of my life for probably 25 years, and the first thing I did was throw up. And I remember being about 2 years sober, and I was out here speaking, and I pulled a counselor aside that I knew, and I had heard her talk in a meeting somewhere else one time about an eating disorder. And so I asked her, hey, can you help me with that? And she said, Sean, you've got all the tools you need inside this book right here on page 59. Just keep working the program that you combated your alcoholism with, and you'll have some success with that eating disorder. And I did. It worked. It also happens to be my first sign of relapse when I'm not spiritually fit. Pretty convinced at this point in my life at 6 years, and I know it's dangerous to say, but pretty clear I'm not going to drink again in this life, and I'm pretty sure I'm not going to use drugs, but I'll make myself sick with some cheeseburgers in a minute, and I'll fuck myself up with a box of donuts faster than you can blink your eye. I will. I mean that sincerely. You know, when I don't feel well, I go straight to the kitchen, and I eat about enough food for six of you, and then I'm miserable for 12 hours. And I still struggle with that to this day. So I found these two underlying themes in the way I grew up, fixing the way I felt with money and with food. I guess three, the attention. I found early on that I really liked adrenaline and danger. And so I would do some really crazy shit. Some of it was just plain dumb. I remember one time stepping on a rusty nail just because somebody dared me to and said that I wouldn't. And so I did. I stone cold sober, jammed a 3-inch rusty nail into the bottom of my foot. And then went home and told my mom what I had done, and she proceeded to beat the shit out of me for it. Because that was going to cost some money to go get that fixed, right? Needed a tetanus shot. That wasn't something she could fix at home with a Tupperware bowl and a pair of scissors. So, you know, I continued to do stuff like that, really risky behavior. And this is before I ever knew what drugs and alcohol were. My dad was drink at the time. He was a police officer. He would come home from work, and he would have a pitcher of martinis every night. And I knew because I would make them for him. But never crossed my mind that was anything for me. But I was using these three things to fix the way I felt because I was miserable at home. I didn't feel like I felt in. I wasn't even good enough for my own parents to love, right? My dad didn't want anything to do with me in my mind, and mom just used me as an emotional and physical punching bag. My little brother was 13 months younger than I was, and I learned really fast that it was my job to protect him. I know today that that's not true, but at the time, it was my job to protect him from her. And I did a pretty good job of it, so I took the brunt of anger that two people were supposed to take for myself. I remember having some really good knockdown dragouts with my mom. I mean, physical altercations. And, you know, she wasn't just a slapper or a hitter. She would pick up, because I was her size, anything that she could to equal the playing field and get her aggression out. And it looked like belts and switches and tennis rackets and yardsticks and wooden spoons and spatulas. And so that kind of just exacerbated the adrenaline and the danger for me, because nothing really hurt. Like, I'm learning to defend this shit at home, so you got nothing that scares me. If you want to, in a social situation, if you want to fight, at this point I'm good with it, because it doesn't hurt. I'm being traumatized at home, so it's almost a release to be able to pound on you at school if that's what you want to do, is go out behind the gym and fight. And I guess it was somewhere about 13 I started sneaking a few of those drinks at home from dad, mom. You know, they had a full bar at the house. They always had wine in the fridge and beer in the fridge. And, you know, we've all done the pour out some liquor and put a little water in the bottle and make it look like, you know, nobody knows. I don't know if they ever knew or not. I didn't care if they knew because, you know, that was already taking the ass whippings that were going to come at the end of that. So it wasn't like they had anything else to scare me with. But I found alcohol 13, 14, and by 14 I was drinking every day. And because I had money and I looked a little bit older than I was, having a full beard at a young age, it never was a problem for me to get my hands on alcohol. And so I started drinking just about every day. And back then it wasn't a lot. You know, a few beers here, a few beers there, a mixed drink or something like that. But by the age of 15, it was full-blown alcoholism, and I knew it. It was full-blown alcoholism. I was blackout drinking. And that went away pretty quick, the blackout drinking. I got to be pretty good at it, and I didn't black out anymore. I remember telling my dad once at about 3 years sober that I was drunk every day of high school, and he just could not believe that. It wasn't in him to believe it, but it was true. You know, I told him, Papa wouldn't make something like that up. I spent a lot of time struggling with my parents to accept their part and how we ended up like we did. Both of my brothers are alcoholics as well. One of them stopped drinking, but he's miserable and he still smokes marijuana every day. He stopped because he didn't want to get another DWI. The other one is just uncontrolled alcoholic. And he's the baby. He's probably 39, 40 right now. And so I remember in high school having two lockers, one in the main hallway and one in the shop building. And I always had alcohol in my shop locker, always. And it was shop class was third period, so I would get to that locker about 10:05, and you know, I'd drink on the way to school at 7:30 in the morning, and then about 10 o'clock, it was time to go to the locker and have some more drinks. And, you know, you get 5 minutes between classes, that just meant, you know, a couple of really good pulls off a Jack Daniels bottle or pounding a 40-ounce something to get through the rest of the day, which meant till lunch, because we did have 30 minutes. And I was talking with my kid the other day about her shitty school food. And I remember eating some pretty good lunches in elementary school, but I didn't eat lunch in high school. It was splitting a bottle of Jack Daniels with two other guys across the street from the school. And that's just what I did every day. That was normal for me. You know, the big book talks about our alcoholic life seems the only normal one. That was normal for me. It wasn't a big deal to split a bottle of Jack Daniels with two other kids. It was a big deal to have my own, drink a whole one at lunch, and that happened a few times too. And I went on like that all through 15, most of my 16th year, and 16, I'm a junior in high school, and I broke a disc in my back in PE class and got introduced to Vicodin for the first time. And wow, what a great combination that was, Vicodin and Jack Daniels. And so that never stopped happening again. And it wasn't only a few months later than that, some guys turned me on to cocaine. And that really upped the game a lot. You know, now I'm taking pills every day, I'm drinking every day, and I've found cocaine. And man, I love alcohol, but I love that white powder, I gotta tell you, I did. I never smoked it, I never stuck a needle in my arm, but man, I love to snort cocaine. And being a guy that always had a job, by this time I'm working a 40-hour job in a grocery store after school from 2 to 10:30. And so money was never a problem for me, never. Even through the worst parts of my addiction, money was never a problem for me. So it was never a struggle for me to get my hands on what I wanted. I just always had it. And since I always had it, I never stopped. And I'm the kind of alcoholic that just never took a sober breath. I started drinking as soon as I woke up, and I went hard until I passed out. And I just had this inordinate capacity to do that on and on and on and on and on. Much to the amazement of my ex-wife and children, by the way, and my friends, just how can you keep doing that? You know, I realized early on I didn't like to be hungover, and a couple of drinks in the morning fixed that real fast. And so, you know, it wasn't even morning drinking. It was just, I'm awake, so I'm drinking. That's just how it was. And so I went on like that through high school, you know. I snorted cocaine. I didn't even really smoke marijuana until I was a senior in high school. I was really close to graduation before I tried marijuana the first time. And the first time I tried it, I didn't really like it. It really didn't do a whole lot for me. It made me paranoid. Seemed like a waste. You know, 30 years later, I'd find out I have asthma and I shouldn't have been smoking in the first place. So that didn't really catch for a while, smoking marijuana. I'd do it if it was around, but it seemed to fuck up my drinking a lot, right? It just, you know, I mean, that's my first love. That's my go-to. It's the easiest to get my hands on. It's the most socially acceptable. And so I went on like that, you know, right through graduation. Coming from that place of, you know, being in that abusive household and that dysfunctional environment, I couldn't wait to get out of there. So I was already enrolled to go into the Air Force. Graduated early June 1985, And for graduation, one of my dad's brothers and one of his sisters bought me an airline ticket to come to Texas. And so I was going to come down here and spend the summer with them, or a length of time before. I think I was enrolled to go into the Air Force in like May of 86. And so I came to Texas, and I remember being out in Oak Hill somewhere at somebody's house, one of my uncle's friends, watching the Super Bowl. It was January 26th, 1986. I've been here exactly 3 weeks to the day. And we were smoking marijuana and drinking tequila and pounding beers, and the halftime came of the Super Bowl, so we got inspired to go outside and play some football in the backyard. And it was raining, and it was muddy, and it was slippery, and I slipped and shattered my kneecap on a rock planter. And it was bad. I mean, it turned my patella into sand. And, you know, oddly enough, I'm so fucked up I don't even feel this. Between the alcohol and the drugs and going into shock, I really don't feel anything. But as I'm riding to the hospital in the back of my uncle's truck, they cut my pant leg open. And when I saw what I saw, it scared the shit out of me. And so back up to the back injury, this is already my second major injury by the age of 18, right? Second really traumatic, life-altering injury in less than 2 years. And at the time, I don't see that it's connected to drugs and alcohol at all. It's just bad luck. It's just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Emergency surgery that night, within an hour, try and save the leg. Doctor looks at me and he says, if it had been one more hour before you got here, we'd be taking it off above the knee. Right? And that scared the crap out of me. But it also did another thing. It gave me another level of painkillers without having to struggle. Like, I don't have to lie, cheat, or steal to get my hands on this stuff. It's coming from a doctor. So it's okay. I'm on my own. I'm living with two of my dad's brothers who are alcoholics. My parents are 3,000 miles away in Washington State, on the Canadian border up there where I grew up. And now I'm incapacitated. I've got a full-length cast on my left leg from the top of my ankle up inside between my butt cheeks. It's so high. And I don't really have a way to get around. I'm immobilized. But I got time to drink and snort cocaine and take pills, right? Feel sorry for myself. Boy, that worked good. A lot of self-pity wrapped up in all that bullshit. And so I'm looking at this situation going, what am I going to do? And because I had that dysfunctional, that family childhood back there in Washington State, that's the last thing I wanted to go back to. Like, I'm scared to death. I'm in a new city. I grew up in a town of 800 people. Now I'm in Austin, Texas, which back in the late 80s was, I don't know, about 600,000 people. And I'm fucking petrified. I have no way to support myself. My dad's brothers are less than compassionate. They still want to know how I'm going to pay my share of the rent. You know, and I can't even wipe my ass by myself or get any, off and on the toilet. And so I'm petrified, but I'm not going back to the way I grew up. Like, I'm not going home. I don't know what that means, but I'm not going home. And so I started to look at what my options were. And for work, that looked like drive a cab. About all I could do was get in a car. I still had my right foot and my two hands, so I did that for a little while. And I started getting back on my feet a little bit and getting around, and I met this kid. I was doing some landscape work for one of my dad's cousins. And I met this kid that was working with him who turned me on to methamphetamine. And boy, howdy, what a great elixir medication that is for rebuilding your life. and I say that in jest and in seriousness at the same time. I did what I needed to do to take care of that leg, or what I thought I needed to do, if that includes drinking and snorting cocaine and meth at the same time and taking pills. About 6 months later, I was up in a tree. You know, I'm back to landscaping with my dad's brother, this guy that owns a tree business, and I got this full-length cast on my leg still. And, you know, because I'm that maniac adrenaline junkie, I'm up there playing fucking Tarzan with a chainsaw. And I'm coming, blasted out of my mind, mind you. I'm coming out of this tree, and I burned my hand on a rope. Yeah, I'm not tied in, because I'm a badass. I don't need to tie in, right? Who needs a rope and saddle? I'm just going to Tarzan down that fucking rope. And I burned my hand, and I let go about 3 feet from the ground, and I fell, and I landed on my feet, but I jammed that leg, and I bent those pins and wires, and I had to go back and have that same surgery a second time at 6 months. Only now I'm so fucked up that the medication they're giving me isn't even touching that shit, so we got to step it up another notch, right? Only I'm not telling them I'm doing meth and cocaine and still drinking around the clock. And so I had the next surgery, I got back on my feet, and I just kept going. And I went like that for about a decade. You know, inside that decade, I met the woman that would become my wife. And that was a perfect match made in heaven, because she's a real addict too, right? So she got no problem with me doing any methamphetamine or drinking around the clock or doing cocaine or doing pills. She's got a little boy, came ready-made family, and so we started playing house together and just living our lives and working and partying, raising this little boy. And nothing really changed. I take that back. One thing did change. Methamphetamine allowed me to really focus on work and I got really successful. I'm a high-functioning addict. I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but you know, I'm doing copious amounts of these things that take most people out and render them useless on their couch, and I'm working around the clock, and I'm getting pretty successful, and I'm making money, and I'm growing this business. I decided after I got fired from my job at Safeway at 19 for being a little too arrogant that if I was going to drink like this and keep a job, I was probably going to have to start doing something for myself. So I did. I got self-employed. I pulled together a few $100s and I bought a used car and a lawnmower and I started landscaping for myself. And to this day, I'm grateful to methamphetamine for helping me do that, because it was a critical component. You're laughing, but I'm telling you the truth. You know, I was able to work 18, 20 hours a day, still hold my family together, keep my house going, keep my kids going to school, and grow this business into what turned out to be quite a little empire for us. I was very successful at it. I had, you know, we're here at the ranch. I had a little ranch not too far from here. We could probably hit it with a rifle. It was that close. I really did. Had some land out there in Mustang Ridge at the top of the hill. And, you know, that ranch came a little bit later, but it was as a result of the success of running that business. And that in the early days, It was doing meth and working 15, 20 hours a day that put me into that successful spot. So I still, all these bad consequences are happening throughout my life, these injuries, these pretty heinous injuries by my standards, and I can't correlate them to alcohol and drugs. It's just the synapse is not closing. There's these injuries, and then there's just this normal life that Sean Castile lives when he's trying not to feel that past that he had behind him. And things got pretty good. They got really good for Tommy and I. You know, we were going, moving along. You know, by this time, Brandon's, 10 years old, something like that. I'm real bad with dates and times. But we decide we want to have another baby. So I'm about 28 years old or something like that at this point. And we decided to put down the meth when Tommy got pregnant. And so we just did. We just put down the meth. Now, she put down everything else, and I didn't. You know, of course, I made that commitment. Yeah, I'm going to stop with you. And that was all I did, was make a commitment, because I didn't stop drinking for one fucking day. That wasn't going to happen. That's what I do. I'm a real alcoholic, and I drink around the clock when I'm awake. And so we did that. Somewhere in there, I'm a little gray on the dates and times, but somewhere on there, I did get sober. I decided to put everything down. And so I cleaned up for, I guess, about 2 years. I didn't smoke, I didn't drink, didn't smoke any marijuana, put down the cigarettes, the alcohol, the meth, the cocaine, the pills, all of it. And, you know, I say I got clean. I really didn't get sober. I remember the defining moment. Tommy and I had a fight, and so I jumped in the truck with as much beer as I could put in the cab of that little two-seat pickup, and I went out to the creek that I used to sit at and drink my sorrows away. I drank, a case or two of beer out there. I decided it was time to come home because it was already 10 o'clock at night and I'd probably been gone all day. We lived over in Dove Springs in East Austin. And I was coming off I-35 at the Stastny exit, and there was a guy hitchhiking. And I was just like, whatever, I'll give him a ride. So I picked this guy up and ended up taking him to San Antonio. Right, I'm on my way home, and it seemed like a good idea to take this guy to San Antonio. What I didn't tell you that I just remembered right now is I'm eating Valium at this time. A lot of Valium. Like, I don't know, 90 a day, right? I'm fucking a bottle of blue Valiums and a couple of cases of Shiner Bock. So, long story short, this guy rolls me for my phone. I don't even know it, in the cab of this little Mazda pickup, and he gets out, and I'm on my way back, and I was somewhere over there by Schertz and Selma, and I got pulled over. And I'm thinking, this is not good. This is not going to end well. I'm so fucked up at this point, the guy rolls up to the window, and he says, can I see your driver's license? And when I let go of the steering wheel to go for my wallet, I just went limp. And I drove away from that roadside stop with a speeding ticket. Okay, I'm in a single cab Mazda pickup with two seats and the floorboards full of Shiner Bock bottles. And I still to this day have no other explanation for how I drove away from there other than there really is a God and he's been looking out for me for a long time before I had a working relationship with him. So that was a Saturday night. I went home. I fell into bed. I didn't wake up till Monday. And Monday when I woke up, I had a buddy that had been to court-ordered AA. So I called him and I said, Bob, I need some help. I think I need to go to a meeting with you. And that's that time when I sobered up for those 2 years. So I would go to these AA meetings. I remember going down to the Bolden Clubhouse and sitting in the back and not really talking to anybody. And I got a book and I read it and I asked this guy to be my sponsor, but I never really called him or did anything with it. And so 2 years go by and well, things are going pretty good. I didn't have any heinous injuries in those 2 years, and the fights got less and less at home with the wife. And we were out playing pool one night, her and I and my brother, and that thought came, I'm good, I got this, I can have a drink. And so I did. I ordered a Shiner Bock. They were drinking. They'd done it many times in those 2 years that I'd been sober, or dry. And the worst thing that could have happened to an alcoholic like me did happen that night. I drank 3 beers and I went home and went to bed. It's good, right? It's the worst thing that could have happened to me because that just solidified, you got this, right? And so I did it again the next night. And I did it again the next night. I drank 3 beers and I went home and went to bed. Sometime in that next week, I got drunk. And I never took another sober breath till I was 44 years old. The only times in between 29 and a half years old and 44 that I was sober was jail and surgery. That was it. And so I want to hammer that home that thought did come. I've got this. 2 years, life's good. The consequences have stopped. The fights have stopped. The emotional turbulence at home has stopped. And I can have a couple of drinks and get away with it. Right? We all have those thoughts from time to time, I believe. I'm not going to tell you do, but I believe we all have them from time to time. That's an opinion. But yeah, that was the worst thing that could have happened because I didn't take another sober breath for a really long time. And so at this point, I'm just stumbling along, living my life. Things were good sometimes, and things were bad sometimes, and things were really bad at home sometimes. And fast forward a little bit, I'm just around the clock drinking, around the clock pill tanking. I'm 39 years old. I'm at an HEB on Riverside. Guy steals something out of the back of my truck, and I take off chasing him. I get about halfway out the parking lot, and I feel this pop in my left hip, and I stop. Okay, I go back and get the truck. My brother was with me, so he finished chasing the guy so we could beat the shit out of that poor fucker for trying to run from us with a car jack. So I go to the doctor, see what's going on with this pain in my hip, and I spent 6 months trying to convince these doctors that there was something wrong in my hip, and they were telling me there was something wrong with my back, and it was referral pain. And so by the time I finally get a diagnosis, I've got stage 4 avascular necrosis, which means my femoral head had collapsed. And to this day, they won't tell me what they think it was, but I'm convinced it was all the years of alcohol and drug abuse. And so I'm 39-year-old white male, and I'm having my hip replaced. And so that means a bone saw and cutting through my femur. It also means a lot of really next echelon painkillers, right? So I start down here, and then I do here with the back, and I do here with the knee, and now they're cutting through a major bone, and they're like, we're just pretty much going to throw whatever you want at you at this point, and we're going to give you a pain doctor who back then would just give you an unlimited supply, right? They're finally starting to see the error of their ways today, right? Some of the best drug dealers I ever had were certified medical professionals, and I mean that in every sense of the word. So by this time, home life is just terrible. You know, I'm starting to turn into my mom. Emotionally abusive, right? Mostly emotionally abusive. I don't ever remember being too physically abusive to my children, but I always... I justified that to my ex-wife because I was physically abused and I thought it was a lesser form of abuse at the time and have since seen the error of my ways in that. So we attempted to struggle on for another 3 or 4 years after that. We got separated a couple of times. And I guess I was about 43 or 44 and I got asked to leave my own house. And that was a pretty painful tragedy in my world. By this time, I'm out of control, reckless. I'm starting to lose things. I'm having injuries all the time. I'm losing, my business is backsliding. I'm fighting with not only my wife, but my kids, right, on a regular basis, having altercations with my children, whom I claim to love, right? And so that's making me feel more and more like my mom. And so I go homeless. You know, I still got a little bit of resources. I've got some money in my pocket. I've got a truck. I've got a savings account, but I spent the next 2 years just kind of wandering the earth, pissing my life away. And so now I'm 44 years old, and I'm homeless for the second time in my life about, I don't know, probably 3 or 4 months, really. I don't have a grasp on what that really looked like, but I realized pretty quickly that this is not working for me. I do not enjoy being homeless. And I say homeless. I never slept under a bridge, and I never flew a sign because I had too much pride, right? But I was sleeping outside. I was sleeping on the ground in parks, waking up in ants in sprinklers, with my shoelaces tied to my bicycle, and guys trying to drag my bicycle off. And you know, it was bad. It was ugly. And so I started running the psychiatric emergency service route. You know, I'm still addicted to everything I can get my hands on when I can, but I'm lacking resources at this point, and things are starting to get ugly. The health is declining rapidly. I'm bouncing in and out of the emergency room at Brackenridge. And somebody, I don't know who, turned me on to Osar, who said something to me that I'd never considered in my life, like, would you like to go to treatment? And I said, well, for what? And they said, to get sober. And I said, well, why would I do that? Like, I never knew anybody that got sober, really. I mean, except for that one experience with AA, but I didn't really know any of those people. And so I'll speed this up a little bit because I know we're running out of time. I end up getting a call from this intake person at OSAR and said, we can get you into Austin Recovery. I'm thinking, okay, I don't know what that is or what that really means, but what I really want at this point is for my ex-wife and my kids to take me seriously, you know. I moved pretty fast past the fact that she divorced me because she just didn't know what else to do with me. And to this day, I'm convinced it's probably the second hardest thing she ever did in her life after getting sober was ask me for a divorce. And I don't say that with any amount of arrogance at all. I say that from the heart because I've seen the pain. I caused it. And so I end up somehow, through the workings of the universe, making my way to Austin Recovery. I love coming out to the ranch, but I did not go to the ranch for treatment. Back then, in 2011, they had a facility on Slaughter Lane called the Lodge for state-funded men. And so I went there, and it literally changed the course of my future, those 30 days there. I really had burned my entire world to the ground and had, I say this a lot. I'm the kind of alcoholic that likes to hang on tight to stuff. So I had to let go of everything in my world before I could hang on to sobriety with both hands. And that's what it took for me. And this higher power that I worship today, that I have this working relationship with in my life, he knew that. And so he saw to it that I systematically erased everything in my world so that I would have nothing else to focus on. Because if I had anything else to focus on or any lurking ideas that I was going to be able to fix this problem by myself, it wasn't going to work. So I was able to hit that treatment center completely broken and humbled and be exposed again to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God I was. I jumped in pretty quickly to doing everything they asked me to do in spite of the fact that I really didn't want to. I made the correlation between having the things in my life that I want being a direct result of doing the things that I don't want, and having the things in my life that I don't want being a direct result of doing the things that I do want. And thank God I had that awareness. So I got a sponsor, and I started working the 12 steps. You know, I got a 30-day stay from them at day 29. They're asking me, what are you going to do when you get out? I got no answers. I don't know what I'm going to do. No clue. Nobody that I've ever been related to or lived in a house with wanted to talk to me, so calling any of them was out of the question. I ended up going to a sober house. Had a little tiff with the owner and got kicked out in 3 weeks. Apparently they don't like you having guns in sober houses. Let alone a lot of them. And since I'm a selfish, self-centered alcoholic, the thought that you might get a parole violation by being in a house with me with a gun never crossed my mind. And so I went to stay with a friend of mine for about 4 months at her house with her and her kids, and quickly outwore my welcome there, although we're still friends today. And I moved into an Oxford house and ended up staying there for 2.5 years. And that fine program gave me something that I thought I had at that point in my life that I did not have, and that was discipline. So I highly suggest sober living for anybody that's considering leaving here and not knowing what you're going to do. I'm 44 at this point, right? I got 3 kids. I've had a business. I've owned a couple of houses. And I think I got discipline, and I did not. I had no idea what that meant, but I found it living at Oxford. So I just continued to do everything that my sponsor asked me to do. In the last 5.5 years, life has gotten really big and full and rewarding. And it just kept doing that in little increments. I remember many times in the Oxford house thinking, you know, if life never gets any better than it is today, I'm okay with this for the next 50 years. And I got really happy in that Oxford house. And it was such a great way of living the program of Alcoholics Anonymous inside an Oxford house, that when my ex-wife finally hit her bottom and went out, my 11-year-old daughter decided she wanted to come live with me in a house full of men. Right? And she did. She came and she stayed with us for 6 months. And to this day, she continues to prefer being in rooms full of people that are in recovery rather than in the outside world where people are pretending like shit's okay and they're okay. Okay? One of the things that endears her to me the most is modeling for her that things are not okay all the time. But I am. It doesn't matter what's going on in the outside world. I've found some tools to be able to combat all those things. So you'll remember at the beginning of this talk, I talked about I'm pretty sure I'm not going to drink again in this life. I'm fairly certain of that. There's times when I think about it, but the new default has been going to the tools that I've found working this program. Life has gotten really good. I've got a great job. I've got a beautiful girl in my life. My kid lives with me today. You know, I have a car. But what I value more than anything in this world is my awareness. Right? That's what I thank God for first every day, is my awareness of what this life is really about. I used to have one or more of everything that the outside world had to offer, and it just didn't buy me any peace of mind. There was never enough. It never filled that hole. I'd be remiss if I stood up here and told you that everything's okay. I still struggle with a lot of my character defects on a daily basis. I'm still a professional procrastinator of epic proportions. I took my car to the shop the other day, and I had a check engine light come on the day before I put my car in the shop. And when I went to pick it up, the guy said, "You know what that code was?" I said, "No, that's why I brought it to you." He said, I've never seen that code before. It said no oil. I ran a landscape business for 25 years. I've probably bought a couple of tankers of oil in my life. But I put shit like that off. And I know today that that's my disease setting me up to have this chaos in my life, which is just an excuse to go use. But I can see those things coming today. So if you're new in this program, if you're still in treatment, and if you're doubting that this thing works, I just want to tell you that why I come out here is to tell you that I'm a low-bottom skid row drunk, steal your medication while you're dying of cancer on your couch. That actually happened in my life. And I don't live my life like that today. I've got tools in my life that come out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of having a working relationship with a higher power, not just a belief, because I always believed in God, but a working relationship with a higher power. I've got a support network around me of people that I call when shit gets bad. I've learned to tell on myself. I live a transparent lifestyle, right? I tell one or more human beings on this planet every thought that comes out of my head. I've learned to check myself like that. Life is not always okay, but I am. Tell yourself that. You're okay no matter what. You need to believe that. I'm a big pusher of self-talk and changing the way I talk to myself. I'm also spent most of my sixth year of sobriety working on mastery of the English language, like figuring out what it is I'm saying to myself and to the people around me and asking myself, is it accurate? Right? I love coming back out here. I love coming out here. I'm thankful to all of y'all for being here. And, thank you.